Lecture 22. Revision Without Tears.
Revision comes to all of us, like death and taxes, and it's just about as much fun. In the earlier stages of composing a work of fiction, you're often caught up in the thrill of discovery. You're creating new situations and characters that no one has ever seen before. Whatever frustrations you may experience in the act of creation are often made up for by the sheer pleasure of making something new. But then, having created this beautiful, lively, imaginative, world-changing draft, you now have to sit down and look for everything you did wrong. Revision is about confronting your own mistakes, which were usually made with the highest hopes and the best intentions, and fixing them in such a way that the reader never knows there were any mistakes to begin with. Not only can revision be hard, unpleasant work, it can lead to despair. The novelist John Gardner, our friend who wrote The Art of Fiction, was once so frustrated with his novel Grendel, which is a retelling of Beowulf from the point of view of the monster, that he threw the manuscript into a fire. Luckily, his wife retrieved it before it could burn, and when Gardner calmed down, he went back to work and finished it. Not all of us take such drastic action to avoid having to revise, but at one point or another, we've all felt the same way John Gardner did. When you reach the end of a draft that you've composed in a white heat, you can believe that you're the greatest writer since Shakespeare. Then when you read it over the next morning, you can feel like the worst hack who ever drew breath. It's enough to make you want to give up and go to law school like your mother wanted you to. Much of what makes revision difficult is that you have to consider your draft on every level, more or less all at once. It's the one time in the whole process where you cannot avoid having to think about everything. Not only do you have to ask yourself if the entire narrative works as a whole, you have to ask yourself if all the individual parts do what they're supposed to, and if they all pull in the same direction. Is each character complete and believable? Did I use the right point of view, the right verb tense, the right setting? Does each chapter round off and lead to the next? Does each scene? Are my sentences interesting, elegant, and memorable? Having to think about all of this at once is daunting, to say the least, but there are ways to approach it that can make it less intimidating. The first step of revision is to start thinking about it from the very beginning of your project. You need to prepare for it from the moment you first start writing. Remember that saying from Nick Lowe that I mentioned in the last lecture, "Bash it out now and tart it up later." For the longest time, I used to keep that motto on an index card that was taped to the wall over my desk. In the last lecture, I cited it mainly as a reminder that you should forge ahead as energetically and heedlessly as necessary to create your drafts in the first place, that you shouldn't worry too much to begin with about length, consistency, economy, and so on. But look at that motto again, and take note of the fact that it comes in two parts, bash it out now, and then tart it up later. Both halves are equally important, and that second half serves as a subconscious reminder that even during the honeymoon period when you're making something new, getting the story down is only the beginning of the process. The motto reminds you, even during the heat of composition, that you're going to have to change things later on. In other words, composing and revising are inextricably linked. How you revise depends in large part on how you compose the draft in the first place. As I explained in the last lecture, there are different ways of composing drafts. You can write a whole draft of a complete narrative without looking back, or you can do individual drafts of each section or chapter before you go on to the next one. By choosing one of these methods over the other, you're necessarily choosing how you're going to revise. If you write a whole draft without looking back and don't start revising until it's done, then you've got all the revision to do at once. This may make revision seem grim and joyless because you're looking at rewriting days or months of previous work. Still, forging ahead without having to worry every day about what you wrote the day before can make writing that first draft easier. On the other hand, if you work and rework each individual section before you proceed to the next one, you'll be revising as you go. This may make the revision a little less daunting since you do it in easy stages and not all at once. It becomes part of your daily routine. Of course, revising as you go is no guarantee that when you've reached the end, you still won't have to go back and fix mistakes or even make major changes. Even with the second method, you still reach a point where you have to think about whether the narrative works as a whole and whether all the individual parts do what they're supposed to do. Now that I've scared the bejesus out of you, let me suggest some ways of approaching revision so that you don't feel depressed or intimidated. And the best way to do that, I've decided, is to use an example from my own work, and so I beg your indulgence here to inflict some of my prose on you. My excuse is that I have access to my early drafts and I can remember what I was thinking when I revised them, which I don't have and can't do for other writers. With that excuse out of the way, let me talk about how I revised the opening paragraphs of my second novel, The Lecturer's Tale. In 1997, I published a book called Publish and Perish, which was a collection of three novellas. Each one of these novellas combined supernatural horror with academic satire. The Lecturer's Tale was originally intended to be one of the novellas in Publish and Perish, but the more I worked on it, the longer it got, and it ended up as the longest novel I've written so far. Since I'm talking about the opening paragraphs, you don't need to know much about the book. Suffice it to say, it's the story of Nelson Humboldt, a failing academic who, in the first chapter of the book, loses his right index finger in a freak accident on the quadrangle of the campus where he teaches. The supernatural element in the story comes from the fact that after Nelson's finger is reattached, he discovers he can make anybody do anything he wants by touching them with his reattached finger. Since this is also an academic satire, he uses this power to save his teaching job and then, as he becomes more corrupt, to work his way up to the top of his university's English department. It was intended to be a sort of mashup of Faust and the Broadway musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Here's my original version of the first paragraph, back when I was thinking it was only going to be a novella and not a novel. Bear with me, this is kind of long, and it's not very good. Crossing the quad at noon on a gray Halloween, Nelson Humboldt's finger was severed in a freak accident. Oddly enough, he hadn't been hurrying as he usually did at this time of day, and anyway, Nelson was a tall fellow, standing a full head taller than many of the young people around him. If anyone could see where he was going, it was Nelson Humboldt. On the other hand, this was the busiest class change of the day, as students entered the quad from all four corners at once, in a vast, slowly moving press that swirled with complex currents and eddies. Out of the eddies, little knots would form, students talking loudly in the brisk, damp autumn air, each with a backpack slung over one shoulder. Even when he was in a hurry to get to his next class, Nelson loved this scene. It was the epitome of what life at university ought to be. Bright, good-humored, energetic young people chattering happily about their classes, their lives, their loves, in a hurry to be somewhere else. Unlike many of his colleagues, unlike most of them, truth to tell, Nelson tried to be a fundamentally cheerful man. It seemed to him that all of life should have such heedless momentum. All of life should be so full of hope. But today, Nelson was unusually distracted, and this, he decided, was the reason for the accident. He had just come from the cramped office of the undergraduate chair of the English department, where Nelson was a lecturer, and just 10 minutes before, she had told him compassionately but briskly that the department was being forced by budget necessities to terminate his appointment at the end of the semester. This meant not only that his income would stop on the last day of the year, just after Christmas, and that his academic career had now become well and truly dead in the water, but that his health insurance for himself and his family would end in 8 weeks. Nelson had no savings to speak of and no prospects, the job market being what it was, and now he was about to have no job. And he moved much more slowly than usual through the press on the quad, still in shock, his mind elsewhere, letting himself be buffeted by the currents and eddies of the passing students. The loss of his finger was just the last straw. I think you can see what's wrong with this, as I did when I was writing this lecture and looked at it for the first time in nearly 20 years. The passage doesn't really work on any level. It doesn't work on the micro level of sentences and phrases, which tend to pile up without going anywhere. And it also doesn't work on the macro level of the narrative as a whole, or at least what I imagined the complete narrative to be when I started. A lot of the sentences are just plain clumsy. The very first sentence is a particularly egregious example. Here it is again, in case you fell asleep. Crossing the quad at noon on a gray Halloween, Nelson Humboldt's finger was severed in a freak accident. Grammatically, that sentence makes it sound as if it was Nelson's finger crossing the quad, not Nelson himself. Another problem is that the very first paragraph doesn't really do what a first paragraph is supposed to do. As you may recall, a first paragraph is supposed to intrigue the reader with a character or a situation, and it is supposed to suggest something about the narrative to come. After telling us that Nelson has lost a finger without telling us how, the first paragraph dives down the rabbit hole into a sentimental, metaphorical description of how students mingle on the quad at the center of campus. After that pointless digression, the second paragraph shoehorns in the bare minimum of Nelson's backstory without giving us any visceral, individual details that bring Nelson and his situation to life. We know he has a wife and kids, but we don't know anything about them. We can't see them at all, and we can only barely see Nelson. The only thing we know about him as a person is that he's tall. In fact, that's the worst fault of the whole passage. I opened this narrative with nothing but exposition, with nothing but an undramatic summary. The sentences are clumsy and rambling and inelegant, and there's no evocative detail, and the passage doesn't really suggest much about what is to come. If it had been somebody else's book, I'd never have finished reading that first paragraph, let alone the rest of the story. So, I tried again. Alas, I regret to say that in the second version, the first paragraph didn't change much, so I won't inflict it on you again. But I began to make more of an effort in the second paragraph. Here it is, version 2 of the second paragraph. But today Nelson had been badly shaken, and perhaps he hadn't been watching where he was going. He had just come from the Spartan seventh-floor office of Victoria Victorinix, the undergraduate chair of the English department, where Nelson was a visiting adjunct lecturer. Just 5 minutes before the accident, Professor Victorinix had told Nelson politely but coolly that the department was being forced by budget necessities to terminate his appointment at the end of the semester. Professor Victorinix was a small, slender, steely woman with cropped silvery hair, a penetrating gaze, and the trace of a bemused smile always about her mouth. Nelson appreciated her forthrightness and the fact that she looked at him as she sacked him. Indeed, it was Nelson's glance that roamed all over the white walls and spare, elegant shelves of her office as he swallowed hard and tried not to cry. The emotion would have been an honest response on Nelson's part, but tears wouldn't have changed anything. Professor Victorinix had suffered 25 years of being ignored, condescended to, and worse as a gay woman in academia, and she was unusually immune to the self-pity of wounded young men. "You have our gratitude, of course," she said, "for all your efforts on behalf of the department, though I realize that under the circumstances, that may not mean much to you." This, if I do say so myself, is an improvement, though it still had a long way to go. The bare, unevocative summary of the first version is gone. You get the rudiments of an actual scene with two characters who are actually interacting with each other. One of them even speaks. The second version is better because it's more dramatic. In other words, it's better because I have slowed down and started to show rather than tell. Now, at least, the second paragraph of the lecture's tale was beginning to do what the opening of a narrative ought to do. It puts the reader in the middle of a situation, in medias res, with just enough information to make it intriguing and to suggest what's coming, but without giving everything away. Instead of just telling you what Nelson's problem was, I put him in a room with someone else and showed the situation to you. And not only does that new second paragraph work better on the macro level of the whole narrative, it works better on the micro level of sentences and evocative details. Instead of the nameless, faceless woman who speaks to Nelson compassionately but briskly in the first version, we get a woman who has a name, Professor Victorinix, and she has a physical description. She's small, slender, and steely, with cropped silvery hair and a penetrating gaze. She also has a history. She's a lesbian who has been in academic for 25 years, and she has a personality. She is polite, but chilly. In my original conception of the story, this character only served one function. She was intended to fire Nelson in the opening chapter, after which she was never supposed to appear again. And when I was writing this revision of the opening, it still hadn't occurred to me that she might be anything more. I just wanted to make that opening passage more visceral. This meant I had to make it more of a scene, which meant, in turn, I had to make her more of a character. Now, before I read you the version that appears in the finished book, I want to remind you again that revision often requires you to think about everything at once, from the level of the phrases and the sentences to the nature and importance of individual characters, and all the way up to the shape of the narrative as a whole. The Lecturer's Tale was my third book, but only my second novel. As I told you in the last lecture, I wrote it differently than I had written my first novel. With The Wild Colonial Boy, I had written out four complete drafts by hand. With The Lecturer's Tale, I first used the method that I still use now. I revised it as I went, more or less finishing one section before I moved on to the next, so that by the time I got to the end, the book was more or less finished. But the operative phrase here is more or less, because with The Lecturer's Tale and with every book since, I have found myself having to go back and change something at the beginning of the book because of a discovery I made about the story or the characters later on. Over the course of writing The Lecturer's Tale, I made two discoveries about Professor Victorinix which caused me to go back and change passages that I thought I had already finished. One was that Professor Victorinix was not a minor character, but one of the major characters in the book. For example, she turns out to be one of three major characters who take part in the big, over-the-top climax of the novel. And, in keeping with the supernatural flavor of my satire, I also realize that Professor Victorinix was probably a vampire. I never made this explicit, because the supernatural element in the book was mainly a vehicle for my satire of contemporary literary theory, but I did want to have some fun with the idea. These two discoveries, that Professor Victorinix was a major character, and that she was even scarier than a mere English department chair, forced me to go back to that opening scene when I was nearly done with the whole book and revise it to reflect her new status. So here's the opening scene as it appears in the finished book. Crossing the quad on a Halloween Friday, as the clock in the library tower tolled 13 under a windy, dramatic sky, Nelson Humboldt lost his right index finger in a freak accident. Someone called his name three times out of the midday press of students, and as he turned to answer, Nelson stumbled over a young woman stooping to the pavement behind him. Falling backwards, he threw his hand out to catch himself, and his finger was severed by the whirring spokes of a passing bicycle. Only minutes before, in the shadowy office of Victoria Victorinix, the English department's undergraduate chair, Nelson had lost his job as a visiting adjunct lecturer. He had sat on the far side of Professor Victorinix's severely rectilinear desk, his hands tightly clutching his knees, while she told him with a cool courtesy that the department was forced by budget necessities to terminate his appointment at the end of the semester, only 6 weeks away. "You have our gratitude, of course," she said, folding her slim hands in the icy blue light of her desk lamp, "for all your efforts on behalf of the department." Professor Victorinix was a small, slender, thin-lipped woman with cropped silvery hair and a bloodless manner barely masked by a disinterested politesse. Even during the day, she kept the blinds of her office drawn, and today she sat in the shadows just beyond the direct glare of the lamp. The reflected glow off her desktop emphasized the sharpness of her cheekbones, the deep groove between her eyebrows, the smooth skullcap curve of her forehead. She regarded Nelson with a gaze that seemed to him aristocratic, ancient, bored. Under the circumstances, she said, "I realize that our gratitude may not mean much to you." Nelson swallowed hard and tried not to cry. His own gaze, in order to avoid meeting hers, darted all over the office. His blurry glance took in pale gray walls, rigorously ordered books in steel and glass shelves, a muted etching in a silver frame of the Countess Bathory in her bath. Nelson appreciated that Professor Victorinox looked at him as she fired him. But couldn't she just turn away just for a moment? I'm sorry. Nelson cleared his throat. Don't worry about me. Now, you may not think this is necessarily better than the first two versions, but I think you will agree that it's certainly more evocative and dramatic. It's full of visceral physical details and a lot of vivid imagery. To begin with, I fixed that clumsy opening sentence and made it clear that it was Nelson himself who was crossing the quad and not just his forefinger. I also added more visceral and ominous detail in the very first sentence by adding the clause about the clock ringing 13 under a windy, dramatic sky. The first paragraph is also improved by briefly foreshadowing what's going to happen to Nelson and by deleting that long description of the students milling about on the quad. Both the opening paragraph and the sentences that make it up are shorter, sharper, more detailed, and more focused. It's a more dramatic and more striking opening paragraph. Then, with the next few paragraphs, the narrative shifts slightly back in time in order to do three things. I introduce Nelson, I briefly explain his situation, and I introduce Professor Victorinox. Nelson's fear of the powerful woman across the desk from him is much clearer in this version because I evoke his fear with physical details. He clutches his knees. He swallows hard and tries not to cry. His glance darts all over the room. But even though Nelson is going to be the main character, it's Victorinox who dominates the scene. In fact, looking at it now, years after I finished the book, I'll confess that I rather gleefully troweled on the vampire detail. Victorinox is slender and thin-lipped and bloodless. She has silvery hair, sharp cheekbones, and a high forehead like a skull. I also gave her three adjectives, aristocratic, ancient, bored, that might have come straight out of an Anne Rice novel. Even the setting is designed to suggest vampire. She keeps her office blinds drawn during the day. She sits just out of the cone of icy blue light from her lamp. And again, as in the first paragraph, the sentences are shorter, sharper, and full of evocative and suggestive detail. The glare of her lamp, her rectilinear desk, the steel and glass shelves, the antique etching in a silver frame, even the subject of the etching, the legendary Countess Bathory, who reputedly drained young women of their blood, is another vampire reference. All of this, and some further detail that comes in the next few paragraphs, is intended to reinforce the professor's power and menace and suggest that she's going to be important later on. But it's all told from Nelson's point of view, which reinforces the fact that he's the main character of the book. We see Victorinox and her office from his point of view, and we participate only in his physical and emotional responses. He swallows hard and tries not to cry. He avoids meeting her gaze. He wishes she wouldn't look at him. He has to clear his throat before he's able to speak. Nelson may not get much of a physical description in these first paragraphs, but we get a vivid sense of him as a nervous person. And as soon as he leaves her office, I spend the rest of the chapter showing his accident and filling in his backstory in much more detail. As I was making these revisions, I was thinking about two things at once. I was thinking about both the book as a whole and the needs of the individual scene. And the way I dealt with every level of revision was by adding more detail. I served the larger narrative by introducing Nelson's point of view and by producing a more vivid introduction to Professor Victorinox. I served the chapter by starting with a brief description of the accident and then backtracking a bit to show what happened just before, implying that the rest of the chapter was going to show the accident in more detail. I serve the scene itself by providing more action and dialogue to evoke the situation rather than just describing it. And I serve the prose by making the sentences clearer and more dynamic. However, adding more evocative detail doesn't necessarily mean adding more words. The published opening of the lecturer's tale that I've quoted to you is 377 words long, while that lamentable first draft was 406 words, and it wasn't nearly as memorable or detailed. I used more words in the first version to say less than I did in the final version with fewer words. So what did I learn or gain through these revisions? I learned that, in my work anyway, I often work from the general to the specific. My early drafts tend to be a kind of summary without much detail. My early drafts are often more expository than dramatic. Then, when I look at them again, I ask myself, what would a reader want from this passage that I'm not giving her? For example, what do the characters look like? Where is the scene taking place? What exactly happens in the scene? What do the characters say to each other, and how do they say it? In other words, when you're revising, you need to be your own toughest critic. You want to take all the techniques we've talked about in these lectures up until now, about evoking rather than describing, about using setting to evoke mood, about creating character through detail, about advancing the plot through dialogue, about letting a character's point of view guide the reader through a scene, and so on, and apply them to your draft. However, I hasten to add that not every writer revises the way I do. James Joyce, for example, is said to have added nearly a third of the finished version of Ulysses in the galley proofs, or the sample pages that the printers had already set in type. If you've ever read Ulysses, or tried to, you realize that Joyce was not a writer interested in economy and concision. On the other hand, the American crime novelist James Ellroy developed an aggressively telegraphic style for his later books almost by accident. When his editor told him that he needed to cut 100 pages from the manuscript of his novel L.A. Confidential, Ellroy took an unusual approach. Most writers would have cut whole scenes and characters, but Ellroy kept all his scenes and characters, and instead he cut what he called the unnecessary words from each sentence. Not only did he significantly shorten the book, he, in effect, invented a new telegraphic prose style for himself. I've attempted this in my own work, trying to see how much I can cut out of a paragraph or a sentence without altering the meaning of it, though not as aggressively as James Ellroy. Sometimes, if I'm editing something on my laptop, I play a little game with myself. If a particular paragraph, for example, has 10 lines, I'll try to see if I can get it down to 8 lines. I don't necessarily recommend this technique to everybody. Some writers just aren't interested in lean prose. But if you're going for economy, or just trying to keep a passage from being boring, it's a useful exercise. You might even call it the Twitter technique of revision, since it's very similar to the effort it takes to make a wisecrack or a pithy epigram in less than 140 characters. And because I am old, and I can remember what life and writing were like before spell check and search and replace, I still usually do my revision and line editing by hand with a pen on paper. I do 99% of my composition on a keyboard, but I start each workday by printing out yesterday's work and marking up the text with a pen as I read through it. After that, I enter the changes on the computer file. If I'm pressed for time or feeling unusually contemporary, I might occasionally revise something directly on my laptop without printing it out. But there's still something about working with a pen and a printout that helps me think. Perhaps it's the last vestige of the muscle memory I gained from those 4 handwritten drafts of my first novel. I still have the callus on my middle finger of my right hand from having gripped the pen so tightly all those years ago. I guess I'm afraid that if it ever goes away, my career as a writer is over. Another technique I have found very helpful is to read each draft of a section or a chapter aloud. Many writers do this, and it's an excellent way to pay particular attention to your prose. For one thing, reading aloud is necessarily slower, so you're more likely to catch things like grammatical errors or repeated words. For another, it's a great way to gauge the rhythm and flow of the sentences and to figure out where the paragraph breaks should be. Please note, But I'm not saying that the best prose is that which reads well out loud. There are some very great books, such as Mrs. Dalloway, which would be rather tricky to read out loud. But by reading aloud through the text at least once, by hearing the words spoken rather than just scanning them, you can catch a lot of things that might otherwise slip by you. As an exercise, take the exercise you did for the last lecture, where you tried writing a draft all at once or revising as you go, and reverse the process. For example, if you dashed out something without looking back, sit down with it again and try to figure out whatever you think is wrong with it by using some of the techniques in this lecture. You could read it aloud, for example. And if you rewrote as you went, you might take the same scene and try to add something new to it. Insert a new character, say, or change the setting, or even change the point of view or verb tense. Next time, I'll be talking about how fiction writers do research. And I'll be talking about Hilary Mantel and her research for her historical novels, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, as well as the author Jim Crace, who has a unique approach to doing research for his books.